and I hope this will just be the starting point or the jumping off point for your personal investigations, your personal journey or odyssey, if you like, in learning about this field. Maybe we'll have the opportunity to do another course, some kind of a follow-on course that looks at some of these issues maybe in more detail, or looks at some related areas, regulation, let's say, or antitrust, or whatever it might be. Be sure and let the Mises Institute know if you'd be interested in having some kind of a course that's a spin-off from this. And if there's enough demand for it, I'd be very happy to do something like this again. Anyway, with that having been said, I want to jump right into the fun here. If you have some questions in mind, please enter them in the chat window or email them to me. Jim has emailed a question to me already, which I'm going to look at here in just a second. But I'll give you a minute or two to get yourselves organized while I do the same. So Jim is asking about BP and the role that the flatter hierarchy may or may not have played. I'm not sure that it's a huge role, but it's certainly an interesting one. And I should say, as I said in the discussion question, in the material that sort of introduced the forum, there are several potential organizational managerial issues associated with the spill that haven't gotten a whole lot of attention in the mainstream media. Yeah, but I think that deserve quite a bit more attention. So let me just find your question here, Jim. Okay, so Jim heard a story on NPR this morning, which I didn't hear, about the role of decentralized organizational structures in contributing to problems like the BP oil spill. Apparently there was, the NPR story also mentioned the fairly recent mine explosion in West Virginia that had some of the same problems. I'm just quoting from Jim's email here. Mine workers reported that local supervisors ordered methane detectors disabled, with corporate executives saying it's against policy, and the workers had no knowledge of this. I wonder if Massey has likewise undergone any flattening prior to the accident. If not, would this constitute a counterexample? That's a great question. I mean, obviously, the Harvard Business Review piece on BP is providing, at best, some anecdotal evidence. I'm not aware of any evidence that shows, in general, across a number of different firms and different industries, that flattening somehow causes sloppiness, or that sort of accidents and other problems are more likely with flattening. In fact, the advocates of extreme decentralization argue exactly the opposite. They say that having more decision authority in hands of people who are sort of close to the scene it makes the firm better able to respond to sudden, unanticipated changes. The idea is that if the people closer to the action, at lower levels of the hierarchy, they're the ones who are most directly affected by, or at least are sort of first in line when there's some sort of accident. I mean, look at in BP, right? I mean, the workers who were on the rig, many of whom were killed in the mine explosion, in a sense, they have very strong incentives to maintain the safety of the rig. You might argue that their incentives are stronger than those of the executives at BP headquarters thousands of miles away, whose lives were not literally, sort of on the line. This kind of claim often came up in discussions of manufacturing quality, not accidents of this nature, but even just sort of the famous Toyota assembly line model. Right, a lot of people talk about just-in-time inventory control, and that was an important part of the Toyota model. But having a flatter hierarchy was part of it too. And I don't know if you guys remember, those of you who are at least my age, might remember, it's kind of the build quality of American cars in the 1970s. I mean, it was really horrible. When I was a kid, my parents mostly drove Oldsmobiles and Chryslers and so on. And, just looking around the interior, the pieces didn't fit together well. When you slammed the door, it rattled. It was just sort of low quality. The early wave of Japanese imports, the first Hondas and Toyotas and Mazdas and so on, that started coming to the U.S. in the late 70s, early 80s, had noticeably higher build quality, even though they weren't more expensive cars. The pieces just fit together better. One of the standard arguments is that, oh, sorry, I'm not recording. Thank you for the reminder. On Dim Dim, my bad. So for those of you who are just listening, we just started recording about 5 or 10 minutes into the discussion. So you didn't miss much, only the answers to the final exam. Not a big deal. We were talking about Toyota and GM and flatter hierarchies. I was saying that back in the 70s and 80s, the idea with the Japanese assembly line was that, well, let me put it this way. With the U.S., typical U.S. auto assembly process, if an assembly line worker spotted what he saw as a problem, some problem with a component or with the way components were being attached to each other, in order to do anything about it, he had to request the permission of a supervisor, then fill out a form, and the supervisor would fill out a form, and that would go on to his supervisor and his supervisor, and go on up the line until eventually somebody would, notice the problem and take action, communicate some instructions back down. In the Japanese assembly plant, each worker had sort of a panic button at his own station. So if even the lowest level assembly line worker, if he saw something that didn't look right, he could press a red button and stop the whole assembly line while people would gather around and look at the problem and try to diagnose it and come up with a solution. So the idea was by delegating decision authority to much lower levels of the hierarchy, the Japanese could assure much higher quality, much higher build quality, fewer manufacturing defects and so on, than you would in a more hierarchical, more centralized system like that the U.S. automakers were using, in which lower line assembly workers didn't have authority to do anything except perform their, menial task in exactly the way they were told. Now, if that's true, it seems to suggest that flatter hierarchies in firms like BP might have made it less likely rather than more likely that there would be some kind of a problem, leading to an emergency like the one that happened. Again, as the authors of the HBS piece point out, the BP case is unique in many ways. One of the ways that it's slightly different, although they didn't mention this so much in the article, is that another issue of centralization was that the drillers like BP were relying on government-provided information about sort of the science, so some of the basic engineering data. How likely is it that there would be a catastrophic oil spill, and what would the environmental harm from such a spill be? Well, apparently BP was relying on, as they were required to by law, U.S. government-provided estimates of these things, which turned out to be wildly, wildly erroneous. So one might think in that case, if BP was relying exclusively on its own data rather than data provided by federal authorities, they might have taken more precaution rather than less. Jim also is asking a question about military history. How the army was organized in Vietnam compared to other wars. It's a great question. I don't know enough about it to give a really good answer. It is true that in the 1990s and early 2000s, the so-called Rumsfeld model, the Rumsfeld approach of having kind of smaller operating units with more authority, in a sense, a flatter hierarchy, or at least small military units that were kind of leaner and meaner, that was supposedly Rumsfeld's preferred model. It was mainly for cost containment reasons, but a lot of its advocates argued that this sort of smaller and more nimble force would be more militarily effective, right? The counterclaim is that, during Iraq and Afghanistan, when these became insurgency, counterinsurgency wars, that the small footprint Rumsfeld army was not effective in, those kinds of engagements. And so there's been a lot of interesting debate about this in military history, but I'm not enough of an expert on that really to have much to offer. Dean's pointing out that Toyota was able to restructure some U.S. Plants by, imposing this kind of more decentralized Toyota model, and I think that's certainly true. A lot of observers have claimed that in the last several decades, many, many jobs in manufacturing and in other industries as well have, remembering that those diagrams we were looking at on Tuesday with decentralization on the horizontal axis, that firms on average have been moving more to the right, slowly and gradually over time, the amount of authority given to the typical line worker is much higher today than it was in the past. To some degree, this is seen as a reaction to kind of early industrial practices. Some of you may have heard of the famous management theorist Frederick Winslow Taylor. People sometimes refer to the Taylor style or Taylorism, being the view that firms should operate with a very tight hierarchy. There are these great quotes from Taylor, if you go back and look at, if you look at his writings on, referring to the typical American factory worker as being, little better than an animal who can't think critically for himself, who at best can be expected to follow orders in sort of a menial way. And it is claimed that this mentality underlay a lot of the management practices of the early 20th century, the idea that line workers were just dummies who, couldn't make decisions on their own and had to be told what to do by kind of an enlightened elite, managerial elite. James Burnham wrote about this in his famous book in the 1940s called The Managerial Revolution. To some degree, this is a caricature, and, sort of textbook Taylorism was not really in place even in the early 20th century in the U.S. or in Europe. But there is something to be said for sort of a popular perception that because workers are better educated and because we have new tools that allow firms to empower their workers, better IT and so on, that it is better to move to flatter organizational structures. Is that a one-size-fits-all solution? Clearly not. Does the optimal degree of decentralization depend on the circumstances? Clearly, yes, as we saw on Tuesday. Depends on characteristics of the individuals, characteristics of the environment, the market, the industry, and so on. So we want to avoid, obviously, sort of one-size-fits-all solutions in any industry. But I think it's a fascinating topic. And one thing we didn't really get into last week was the literature on the so-called M-form hypothesis in corporate structure. We talked about Alfred D. Chandler, Jr., who wrote these famous books in the 60s and 70s on the rise of the M-form corporation. We talked about the M-form last week in the context of diversification, that the M-form structure facilitates more diversified product lines than sort of the more integrated, unitary, or what people in that literature call the U-form unitary structure. And that's true. But key to that, to fit into this week's discussion, is the notion that the M-form is a more decentralized organizational structure. Right? The idea of the M-form is that the individual operating units, whether they be arranged according to product type, the light bulb division, the jet engine division, the microwave oven division, or whether they are operated by, say, geographic area, East Coast Division, West Coast Division, whatever. The idea is that the divisions have a lot of autonomy under the M-form. So really, the job of the corporate office is not to manage the production and marketing and distribution of these individual products, but just to manage the overall corporate portfolio. So the M-form is not only a structure that facilitates diversification, whether over products or geographically, but also it's a organizational form you know, that is highly decentralized, and that, according to its proponents, you know, works better in many settings because it frees up the corporate office to think about these kind of long-range strategic and organizational issues, rather than requiring the corporate managers to be stuck day to day, you know, dealing with operational issues. There's also an issue of integration. In other words, adding and removing business units, right? So under the M form, you know, if General Electric, as an M form corporation, you know, wants to get into the business of manufacturing coffee mugs, like the lovely mug I'm holding up for you now, you know, it could simply acquire an existing coffee mug manufacturer and simply add that as another division within the M form. There isn't a lot of, you know, sort of functional integration that has to take place, because the coffee cup manufacturing firm that GE acquires already has its own production, you know, unit, its own operating staff, its own marketing division, its own sales force, right? You just sort of add the whole thing on as a new standalone unit. If your firm is organized in a much more consolidated fashion, where you have one marketing department for the whole firm across all products, one sales division, one operations division, right? Then you have to, you know, for the new acquisition, you have to integrate its sales force with your existing sales force, its marketing division with your existing marketing staff, and so on. So that's a much, in principle, a much more complex way to you know, to sort of integrate a new acquisition than if you had an M-form structure, which is one of the reasons why M-form corporations tend to make more acquisitions, and for that matter, have more divestitures than companies that are organized along functional or unitary lines. So if we think it's important for large firms to experiment with different combinations of assets, with different product portfolios, then adopting the M-form structure would facilitate that experimentation at much lower cost. Grayson. Grayson's talking about Google and its policy of allowing workers to take some time off to work on their own pet projects, even if there's no obvious or immediate commercial application of that activity. That's a great example of a company that is trying to encourage more innovation or more sort of proxy entrepreneurship or more derived judgment, in the language we use Tuesday, within the firm. The most famous example of exactly that practice is 3M. 3M, based in Minneapolis, which has, originally it was a 5% rule. In some divisions, it's up to 10%. The idea with the 5% rule is that each employee would spend at least 5% of his time doing exactly what Google is describing for Grayson, pursuing pet projects, right? Just experimenting, playing around, tinkering, being in the lab, being at their desk, dreaming about potential new products. Right? The idea was a couple things. Number one, this is supposed to stimulate creativity among employees. You know, maybe some of these crazy ideas would end up having some market value down the line, and that's good for 3M's bottom line. It's also regarded in the industry as a kind of perk of the job. So 3M might be able to attract better, more qualified, better motivated employees, because they know that being allowed to pursue their own pet projects during business hours, that's something they enjoy. They get benefits or utility from doing that, and this makes the job more attractive than it otherwise would be. Okay, or you might argue there's a trade-off between salary and other kind of working conditions, right? Maybe 3M can pay workers a little bit less than other firms would pay these same workers, because the 3M workers get this free you know, playtime, which, if they regard that as part of their compensation package, makes up for any lost income, right? In many cases, there are trade-offs between sort of the monetary aspect of the compensation package and the non-monetary aspects, right? Look at college professors, right? College professors like me, especially if you teach in, you know, a business-related area, we all believe I certainly believe that if I weren't a college professor, right? I mean, I'd be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and I would make millions of dollars per year, and have wonderful life of a college professor, where you get to read interesting pay you get to compensate you for an unpleasant job, lifting heavy objects, putting them in trucks, but garbage collectors tend to make more for the fact that it stinks. So the general point I'm getting at here is that in terms of job design or in terms of compensation structure, what we talked a little bit on Tuesday, but didn't have time to go into in great detail, is that salary or payment or compensation isn't exclusively in money, right? It can be in money, but it can also be in fringe benefits, whether tangible or intangible, health benefits or whatever. Could be a tangible fringe benefit, but just happiness, satisfaction, standard analysis lead to increased unemployment, right? That firms don't lay off workers in response mandating that pay a higher wage. Well, I mean, even if you work at McDonald's, right, there are some other margins on which the firm how many breaks do you get? How many vacation days do you get or whatever? Those are all parts of the pay package. And if the firm might reason, well, if I have to pay higher minimum wage, now I'm going to make my workers buy their own uniforms. I'm not going to give away the uniforms anymore. Such that the workers are really no better off than they were before. They're not getting any more in total than they were before. Employers are not paying any more in total than they were before. But the nominal wage is higher, thus satisfying the government. Right? So in a case like that, the firm might not need to let studies of the effect of minimum wage laws can misleading. The general point is we want to look not just at the wage of the salary, but if it's a part of the be an example of that, right? That maybe by driving decision authority down in the military, operations, research, a lot of logistics and supply chain management and so on. A lot of these have been for... Oh, I don't have Carl with us today, so somebody's got to pick up the slack and ask all the questions that Carl would have asked. Okay, here's a question from Dean. Read this. From Jensen and Mecklen, what practical difference in social and legal sanctions? Perhaps that legal sanctions include the right to commit violence, to instance, true, or rights are defined as legally enforceable claims. Do legal and social obligations tend to converge over time? If so, does one approach the other, or is the convergence bilateral? Wow, that's a really fantastic question. Off the top of my head, heck, I don't know. I have to think about that. Let me, rather than answer the question directly, let me generalize it just a little bit. We could think about this between sort of formal and formal sanctions. So one example would be sanctions would be much more powerful, right? Especially in industries where reputation effects are very strong. I sometimes think about buying a used car, as pertains in some degree to our Market for Lemons example, right? The famous Market for Lemons story to illustrate the problem of adverse selection is the one in which the seller of the used car knows more about the underlying quality of the car than the buyer, right? So if buyers know this, they'll be reluctant to make offers to these sellers, right? So suppose that I'm trying to buy a particular model of car, a 2004 Toyota Camry, and suppose I know from looking up on the internet that, you know, the average 2004 Camry within certain parameters, you know, is worth about $10,000. I don't know what any individual Camry on the market is worth, but I know that that category of car as a whole is worth about 10. The problem is, now I worry that, well, if I offer 10 for a Camry, Camry that actually relies better than average, it's worth more than $10,000. And so that buyer is not just be willing to sell his car for anything less than what the seller perceives its value to be, maybe $11,000 or $12,000. I mean, if somebody owns a particular Camry that has been, you know, that has not been a good car, that's been a lemon in the last, language of used cars, right? It's only worth out. So you might say, well, you know, if you're worried about that, why not just offer a lower price? Just offer $8,000. But see, that doesn't solve the problem either. Then I have the same problem. Anyone with a car worth more than $8,000 that the seller knows is worth more than $8,000 will not be made available to me at that price. Whatever price I offer, I only get made available to me, the cars that are worth less than what I offered. So I always get stuck with a lemon, and hence, people think, well, then the used car market just, you know, totally breaks down. A couple comments that this argument is objective or common. There's a true underlying value to the car, $8,000, $10,000. If we treat value as subjective, as being only in the minds of individual buyer and seller, then this analysis is much more difficult to apply. Right? Point is that originally offered Jackal in 1907 was not to name that exist, but rather to show that certain institutions that facilitate abuse. Like, if I'm at my memory is a good that no one would be because they like some issue a warrant offer and goes back to your away signal to potential buyer, I have a better than average car. I'm willing to put my money where my mouth is. Also, when you go to buy a used car, right? What do? Well, you try to, okay, so in the language of principal agent theory or asymmetric information theory, the party with less information, the uninformed party, the buyer, can seek to become informed or to acquire the information that the seller has, you know, by investing in information gathering, by doing research, by looking it up on Carfax, or by taking the car to a mechanic to have it inspected. A third mechanism for mitigating this problem is reputation. Right, which is why I brought this up in the first place. I sometimes ask my undergraduate students, you know, would you rather buy a used car from a dealer or from an individual? Now, many people initially say, well, an individual, because they probably get a better price. Their markup, they don't have a big markup like a dealer has. That could be true. But a hazard from buying from an individual is that they may be a one-time player in the market. And if you end up unhappy with the car that you bought, it turns out to be a lemon after all, despite your best efforts to avoid lemons. That makes you unhappy. But if the seller, is never going to try to sell a car again, well, that's not really going to hurt the seller. The seller doesn't care about repeat business. Whereas if you buy from a dealer, right, the dealer plans to be in the business of selling many used cars over time to many people. If the dealer sells me a lemon, well, I'm going to get mad. I'm going to tell all my friends. I'm going to post nasty comments on different websites. So not only will I never buy a car from that dealer again, maybe my friends will never buy from that dealer again anyway. My friends will never buy from that dealer either. That hurts the dealer. It hurts the dealer's reputation in the market. Makes it harder for the dealer to earn profit in the future. So the dealer will tend to prefer not to sell me a lemon, to make an effort not to sell me a lemon today in order to reap higher benefits in the future. If you like, my refusal to buy from this dealer, my attempt to organize a boycott or to smear, to besmirch the seller's reputation in the market, social sanction case. Whereas my, to sue are much more, they're more lawsuit. So in a case like that, social sanctions might be more effective than legal sanctions. On the other hand, the social sanction may hurt. It doesn't put any money in my pocket today. It hurts, but it doesn't really how. Whereas legal sanctions might money in my pocket. There are pros and cons of the two different methods. A point is that I think in the mainstream literature, the effect of social sanction is probably downplayed. The focus isn't seriously as it should be. Think about name brands. It's another example. People say, well, if we didn't have the, the Food and Drug Administration or some other government body testing drugs, we would have all these dangerous drugs on the market. Well, look, in the absence of the FDA, we would expect the market to place more emphasis on brand name reputation. And nobody would buy generic pharmaceuticals. You wouldn't buy drugs, buy ibuprofen or whatever, unless you had a lot of confidence in the reputation of the seller. And for that reason, the seller would invest a lot in protecting its brand and would have a strong incentive to test, to make sure that unsafe products don't get onto the market, to take action with recalls and whatever as soon as they do. And those incentives would presumably be much higher, stronger for the company than they would be for some government agency. Okay. Let me look for some other questions here. Just check my email. Hold on just a sec. So chime in with some more questions while I'm looking. Be thinking of more questions, writing more questions. Okay. Okay, another great question from Dean, a couple of them. You mentioned at some point that economists believe in the efficient markets hypothesis. Right, one upshot of the efficient markets hypothesis is that stock prices always reflect all known information. But Fahmahead and French have written at some length about the systematic outperformance of a specific class of stocks, namely small cap. Right. They've even developed a model which incorporates measures of market cap and book value into estimates of a stock's beta, right? As most of you probably know, finance professionals characterize securities in terms of different variables, the most important one being the beta, right? Which has to do with the correlation between the returns to that stock and the returns to the market as a whole. So you want a stock that the most desirable stocks are those that beat the market in this sense. Dean says, isn't this evidence against the EMH? Yeah, I want to think about that a little bit more before answering, because you're right. An implication of the efficient markets hypothesis would be that for stocks that are thickly traded, right, for which information is widely available to the market, we would not expect any systematic performance differences among particular classes of stock. So, because the only reason that a stock would ever increase in value is because new information has been revealed, and by definition, nobody would know that, right, unless they're insiders, unless they're insider trading. Dean, you'll have to remind me what Fama's evidence and people like Malkiel and so on, what their argument is on the benefit of small cap versus large cap securities. I don't remember what their argument about small caps is, so you'll have to remind me. But yes, if one were to show that one type of security, systematically outperforms others in a way that you can make a convincing case that it's not just luck, it's not just random, then that would be evidence against the efficient markets hypothesis. Right? So what the empirical finance literature has done is, asked if you can fit various, can you fit curves to the observed stock price data? Are stock prices really a random walk, meaning they change only in unpredictable ways? Or can you fit some, essentially fit trend lines to them with fancy econometric modeling? And the evidence is kind of murky on this. There are a lot of studies showing, yes, stock prices do appear to be a random walk. Others say, no, you can't rule out the possibility that there are various kinds of trends. There are different kinds of trend curves if you add a random component or a so-called drift component that are also consistent with the data. This is a hotly contested argument within finance. Yeah, Dean, if you can find, an article that deals with this, please share it with me and with the others, because I just don't remember what their claim is exactly. There was an interesting interview with Fama, which I can find. I think I blogged about it on Organizations and Markets several months ago. He was pretty unrepentant in response to claims that a lot of people have made in the last couple of years that, the financial crisis was, let's say, exacerbated by, valuation models that, that are built from Fama's own arguments about securities pricing. The Fama French formula for options pricing and so on, was used explicitly by companies, and that gave them all kinds of valuation problems, and that's why nobody knew what a mortgage-backed security was worth and so on. And Fama argues pretty strongly that no, his view of finance, the efficient market story, the random walk approach are, just as right as they ever were. That nothing about the financial crisis invalidates in any way the sort of models that these quants on Wall Street, building largely on people like Fama, have come, came up with. It's pretty interesting and worth a read. Other issues or questions? I think somebody asked, can't remember when this was asked, about specifically Austrian critiques of the efficient markets hypothesis. There are a couple that have been published in the Review of Austrian Economics and or the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. If you look on those, if you search their websites for efficient markets hypothesis, there's some good Austrian critiques about this. One, of course, being that if one takes the kind of Hayekian division of knowledge, like we were talking about on Tuesday, seriously, you can't credibly believe that all market participants, have exactly identical information about the future prospects of particular securities, of particular firms. I mean, that sort of negates the idea of financial market entrepreneurship. But Hayek would argue, and I think Mises would argue, and I would argue, that no, some participants, both in financial markets, in other kinds of factor markets, and in product markets, that they do have some firm-specific, industry-specific, market-specific knowledge, presumably tacit knowledge, that is not available to all market participants, and does allow them to use judgment in a way that other people cannot. Right? So if we believed in the literal EMH, it would be very hard to talk about judgment in any meaningful way in financial markets, because everybody knows exactly what everybody else knows. Everybody can forecast stock prices the same way that everybody else can. And, you know, the only reason people make money in financial markets is because they're lucky. You know, you might as well throw darts at a dartboard than try to pick stocks. If that's true, then there is no such thing as judgment on financial markets. But, of course, there's a lot of evidence and good theoretical arguments that that isn't true, that that isn't the right way to look at securities prices. That's a very neoclassical economics way of looking at it, which, you know, takes the whole notion of information in a very narrow sense, you know, information that can be mathematically characterized and parameterized in numbers. So in the Brickley and in the Jensen and Meckling language, the MH only takes into account general knowledge, doesn't take into account specific knowledge at all. Grayson, isn't the whole notion of an economic hypothesis non-Austrian in the first place? Yeah, I mean, that's. I don't know if you're being 100% serious or partly just trying to be witty and clever. I mean, you're right. If we use the word hypothesis in its formal technical, scientific, or philosophical use, you know, as a statement that can be expressed in a way that it can be falsified by the data, some sort of Popperian notion. Yeah, you're right. Most Austrians do not accept that notion of hypothesis testing. If we take the term hypothesis in a looser sense, just to mean idea or conjecture or whatever, if I say, my hypothesis is that lots of consumers will want to buy my beautiful stainless steel coffee mugs, and then I go and manufacture the damn things, and nobody buys them, and I end up with a big loss, I can say, well, my hypothesis, I have to reject my hypothesis. My theoretical claim was falsified by the data. I mean, okay, if you want to say that just as another way of saying I exercised poor judgment in anticipating what consumer demand for my product would be, okay, that's fine. I guess that's innocuous. But if we mean it in the literal sense of hypothesis testing, yes, Austrians tend not to accept that kind of approach, mainly because hypothesis testing, as it's used in the neoclassical approach, right, is supposed to be a way of creating theory, right? That the way we advance our theoretical knowledge is to, you know, we can choose any theory we want as long as it can be expressed in a hypothesis that can be tested, so-called, against the data, and we see if the data confirm or reject the hypothesis. So only you know, and if confirmed, then we accept it as true and build it into our theory. If the regression coefficients are not statistically significant, then we say the data have falsified this hypothesis and we reject it from the, we leave it out of the received body of theory. I mean, that's a very neoclassical but highly naive way of looking about theory and social science. So Austrians reject that notion of hypothesis testing. Mises has a lot of great critiques of mathematical empirical economics, of the so-called positivist approach, use of the quote scientific method, you know, in doing economics research. But at the same, that doesn't mean that Austrians reject the very notion of looking at quantitative, you know, looking at statistics. Austrians use statistics and even econometrics in many ways, but just not to test theory, but rather to apply theory or to illustrate how the theory applies in a particular context. So I would say, for example, if you ask me, you know, are demand curves downward sloping? I would say yes, and I don't need to perform any empirical analysis to find that out, because theoretical deduction from the basic postulates of economics, using the method that Mises called praxeology, is sufficient to tell me that demand curves are downward sloping. I can get that just from the law of diminishing marginal utility, which I can get purely from theorizing about scarcity, choice, opportunity cost, and so on. And it is the way Carl Menger does it. So I don't need to collect data and run regressions to find out if the law of demand holds, if demand curves are downward sloping. However, if you ask me, what was the demand for stainless steel coffee mugs in Columbia, Missouri in 2010? Well, praxeology doesn't tell me that, right? If I want to estimate the magnitude of the effect, what was the elasticity of demand? Well, I have to collect data and do some analysis, some quantitative analysis to find that out. But I recognize that what I'm doing is not testing the law of demand somehow, merely trying to figure out empirically what was the actual elasticity of demand at a specific place, a specific time, a specific moment in history. Okay. Dean has a follow-up question about flipping coins. I'll just read it silently. Okay, so Mises certainly thought that markets systematically rewarded entrepreneurs who really were better at allocating scarce resources. What is the line of deductive reasoning which results in Mises' position? Presumably the necessity of action under uncertainty fits in the beginning. Yes, you're absolutely right. Mises writes about this in his little 1951 essay, Profit and Loss, I think is the best place where he writes about it. It's really a very common sense argument. Right, that capitalist entrepreneurs are competing with others to acquire scarce resources that they can then transform into consumer goods and try to sell and so on. Excuse me. And you need money. You need cash. Sorry. Entrepreneurs who systematically exhibit poor judgment. Well, they run out of cap. They don't. They spend their own capital. They end up with no capital left over, no financial capital with which to acquire factors of production for the next round. You say, well, why can't they just go to the capital markets and sell bonds or issue stock or borrow from the bank? Well, that's where reputation effects come into play, right? Creditors or equity holders are not going to lend to or invest in the enterprise if the entrepreneur has a poor track record, right? So the reason why a successful entrepreneurship tends to be rewarded is because A, the entrepreneur can accumulate his own funds, more of his own funds, and B, the entrepreneur can acquire funds from others at lower cost. It reduces his cost of capital, to use modern finance jargon. So it's really a very straightforward argument. A pretty intuitive argument that good decisions tend to be rewarded with cash and with the ability to raise cash in the future, whereas poor decisions, bring about the opposite result. So that's pretty, that's pretty straightforward as the mechanism goes. By the way, if you look at one of the chapters in my book, which I didn't assign, is the one that is in the book as Price Theory and Austrian Economics. It was originally published in the QJAE under a slightly different title, The Mundane Economics of the Austrian School. And the argument that's made in that paper essentially is that in the modern Austrian literature, especially in some sort of branches of the Austrian school, there's lots and lots of emphasis placed on market processes and convergence to equilibrium, learning and process through time. What I argue in this paper is that while those issues are important, they've actually been played up quite a bit too much in the Austrian literature, that the Austrians do not reject the notion of equilibrium if that notion is understood correctly. And the whole essence of Austrian economics isn't market process, right? That's just an aspect of the allocation of resources. And again, Mises doesn't write about spontaneous order, and Mises doesn't write about the market process and the convergence to equilibrium. He barely mentions those things. Going back to his first book, his 1912 book on money, he mentions these things in passing, and uses them only in sort of fairly common sense ways to shore up his basic argument, like the one I just made about profit and loss. So I think Mises, Menger, Bombaver, Rothbard, the early Hayek, right, they mention these things only, you know, in ways that are not very controversial. So it's assumed that, you know, better entrepreneurs tend to acquire more capital over time. But there's no sort of fancy, sophisticated, idiosyncratic, philosophical argument needed to generate that. Just pretty straightforward things about capital accumulation. Dean's raising the counterpoint, right, that good luck can appear the same as good judgment. And yeah, that's absolutely right, but that's where this notion, that's where Mises uses the notion of sort of systematic tendency or time trend. Yeah, anybody can get lucky, right? But presumably at some point your luck runs out. Think of the director, M. Night Shyamalan, right, who made the movie The Sixth Sense, which everybody, you know, was a critical and box office success, and people talked about his genius, and he's the next Hitchcock, and so on. And he was able to parlay the success of that movie into funding for lots of subsequent movies, which, according to most observers and many critics, and in my own view, you know, progressively got worse and worse, until you had The Happening, which was really bad, and according to all reviews, The Last Airbender is absolutely horrific. My guess is, you know, Night Shyamalan's movie career is pretty much nearing its end, unless he can afford to finance things out of his own pocketbook. People are not going to give him, investors are not going to give him money anymore. His movies have just gotten worse and worse over time. Same thing happened to other famous auteurs like Francis Ford Coppola, for instance. But look at Steven Spielberg, right? He makes consistently good, as in meaning profitable and critically acclaimed movies over time. So it's much easier for Spielberg to get money from investors now than it is for a guy like Shyamalan, right? So, Dean, you're right that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, it isn't always easy to distinguish judgment, good judgment, from good luck. But systematically over time, good luck tends to run out. But the point that you're making has been made quite a few times in the entrepreneurship literature, not only in regard to Knight's concept of judgment, but as a critique of Kirznerian discovery as well. Critics have also argued, Harold Demsetz wrote a piece, which I can dig up for you, claiming that a Kirznerian alertness also doesn't look any different empirically from luck, and is difficult to distinguish empirically. No, I think you can, again, if you look at systematic tendencies, but that's an empirical, quantitative thing, not a theoretical, that's not praxeological, okay? Hey, yeah, Dean, I don't know if that that gets at your question or not. I hope that it does. Yeah, I mean, the movie example only goes so far. And sure, there are examples of capitalist entrepreneurs who have had a series of successful ventures, been able to raise capital to fund new ones, you know, and then had big blowouts, had big failures. I mean, you know, that, of course, there's nothing. Look, when Mises talks about skilled entrepreneur promoters, he doesn't mean that this is sort of a gift that keeps on giving forever, right? And when there's no guarantee that successful entrepreneur promoters will continue to be successful, I mean, it's not a mathematical law, right? It's a tendency. I mean, who knows? I don't know if any of you guys have an iPhone 4, but look at the iPhone 4 flap. This big controversy now about whether there were reception problems with the antenna, and you know, Apple sort of stonewalled and didn't say anything for the first few weeks, and now apparently there's going to be a big announcement on Friday where Apple will announce either a hardware fix or maybe even a recall or something dramatic. People are claiming the iPhone 4 antenna problem and Apple's handling of it could seriously damage Apple's reputation with consumers as, you know, this magical, wonderful company that can do no wrong. The point is, Apple could blow it, right? Apple has a tremendous amount of goodwill built up among users, tremendous reputation that's reflected in its very high market cap, meaning investors are willing to, you know, to give money to Apple on, you know, preferred terms, because they have a lot of confidence that Apple is going to make money in the future. But Apple could have a big failure, a big disaster, and all that goodwill could go away. You know, suppose that the iPhone 4 did end up being a huge disaster. Suppose Apple, you know, goes bankrupt, goes down the tubes, whatever, as a result of it. I don't think that's likely, but suppose that did happen. You know, would we conclude that, well, Steve Jobs got lucky for about 20 years, you know, great luck, a great run of luck over about a 20-year period, then his good luck came to an end? Well, I mean, I suppose you could, but it seems to me a more reasonable interpretation would be, you know, everybody makes mistakes, and having good judgment doesn't assure that you'll use it, you know, that it'll be good every time. And even the best, most skilled entrepreneurs can make mistakes. The really good ones are able to bounce back from those mistakes. Maybe the, you know, the mediocre ones are not. Right, and of course, it goes without saying, as Dean's pointing out, that in doing this kind of analysis, looking at contemporary financial markets, you know, of course we have to think about the role of the state, right? Not only bailing out large companies, but also this sort of implicit guarantee, you know, implicit too big to fail guarantees, expectations about bailouts and so on, encourage less prudent behavior, so-called moral hazard, on the part of capitalist entrepreneurs. Dean's mentioning, you know, famous long-term capital management case, which is a perfect illustration of that, right? I don't know that the executives at Goldman Sachs are behaving in sort of prudent means as they would as good capitalist entrepreneurs, or to what extent their decisions reflect moral hazard, right? The fact that they know they're going to get bailed out if things get really bad. Yeah, maybe it's not quite the same for a movie producer. The analogy doesn't completely hold. But speaking of movie analogies that may or may not hold, there is an economist named David Galenson at Chicago, Galenson, who's written a fascinating set of papers on art, on artists. And there are a lot of parallels to the entrepreneurship literature. So he describes, Galenson describes, he says, if you look across a number of artistic media, whether it's, you know, painting, cinema, music, literature, you tend to see there are a lot of patterns that are common to different artistic media. Namely, as he says, there are two different sort of types of artists, what he calls conceptual artists and what might be called experiential artists. One type is more makes art that appeals to the emotions. The other type makes art that appeals more to experience, real-world experience. One type of artist tends to peak early in their career. If you look at cinema, you know, Shyamalan would be an example, or Orson Welles, who made, you know, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, movies ever made, Citizen Kane, as a 19-year-old, his very first movie, where he had complete artistic control over every aspect of production. But his movies got much worse over time. Galenson gives the great Western director John Ford and also Alfred Hitchcock as examples of the other type of artist whose films are designed to appeal to experience rather than emotion, and who tend to make their best movies. Their movies tend to get better. They tend to make their best movies later in their careers. I blogged about this on Organizations and Markets as well. I'll find the link for you. Showing that there are some interesting parallels between being an artist and being an entrepreneur in our sense of entrepreneur. In fact, I'll find the link for you right now. Am I back now? Okay, sorry about that, guys. I don't know what I did. Grayson, if you're listening, if I hit the, should I hit the record button again, or will that, is there a chance that might delete the part that was recorded previously? Okay, I won't hit the record button. Sorry, guys. I was trying to open up a new tab on my browser, and I accidentally opened up a new DimDim session, which logged me off. Okay, here's the link I was talking about. That's a link to the article on the scalants and stuff on creativity, which I think is pretty darn interesting. Okay. Other questions or comments? Now I've lost most of the chat thread from before I goofed up. I've got Dean's question about investment banks. I think go back and look at the article by Amar Bidet, right? His claims about how the deregulation of financial markets in the 70s helped to make the allocation of capital more effective, more efficient, and so on. I think it'd be the same thing, right? If you're a capitalist entrepreneur operating prior to financial market deregulation, right? So if they're very, you know, if you're in a state capitalist system, if there are very few providers of financial capital, then your ability to access funds might depend more on social networks and who you know and who you've paid off and this sort of thing than your prowess or skill at being, you know, at exercising entrepreneurship judgment or alertness or whatever it might be. So being in a politically connected or politically hampered environment obviously is a very different thing. Okay, any other comments or questions about this or anything else? Let me check my other email account and see if I've missed any good questions. Okay, Grayson. So the question is, you know, even in the hampered market economy, can we still say that entrepreneurs are trying to do the best they can, you know, as we've, using the techniques and the ways of thinking that we've been talking about all semester long? I would say sure. I mean, operating in the mixed economy, right, the capitalist entrepreneur faces additional hurdles. Right, so negotiating with the state is another aspect of the entrepreneurial process. Trying to protect one's investments against state, depredation is another challenge that the entrepreneur faces. Just to give you one example, I'm on the board of directors of a small financial services firm here in my town, and one thing we've been discussing in the last few weeks is what to do with some cash reserves that we have. Because the members of the board, many of whom read Austrian literature, I might add, are extremely worried about deflation. Extremely worried about inflation, about expansion of the money supply, and, you know, losing the value of the firm's cash accounts by having it all inflated away. And, you know, in what ways can we protect the value of those assets? By investing in commodities, you know, gold, by purchasing real estate? What are some different things we can do as inflation hedges? Look, if we had an economy on the gold standard, or an economy without central bank intervention in the money supply, I don't think we'd be having these discussions, right? If interest rates were higher, we would just leave the money in the bank, in a CD, and be perfectly happy with it. You know, we're not trying to make money with high-risk investments with these cash holdings. We just want to protect the value of our investments. So, you know, how many man hours that could be used to produce goods and services are instead are wasted trying to protect the firm against bad government policy? Well, you know, a lot, and this is something that, you know, reduces the standard of living if you look at it in the aggregate and so on. But my point is, it isn't that this firm is no longer acting entrepreneurially when it tries to figure out how to protect itself against the state. Nor is it the case that, I would say that Goldman Sachs is acting entrepreneurially when it, you know, uses its close ties to the state to get loans, to get bailouts, to get protection, to get XYZ. Is that something that's beneficial to the economy as a whole? No. Right? But if you like, entrepreneurs who excel in political entrepreneurship, who excel in, you know, working the state apparatus to their advantage. I think they're also acting as entrepreneurs, right? They're trying to be alert to opportunities. They're making judgmental decisions about how to invest resources and so on. They're just doing it in at least partly in a non-market context. So I would say, yes, entrepreneurship is still going on in those situations, but it isn't necessarily beneficial to society. It isn't beneficial to us as consumers. Okay, I mean, you know, a government official who comes up with creative new ways to extract tax revenue or to torture people or to whatever, if you like, that person is a political entrepreneur, but they're acting as socially harmful or value-destroying political entrepreneurs. Okay, now, everything that firms do in a non-market setting, in a mixed economy, isn't necessarily harmful. I don't think that a firm trying to protect its balance sheet against inflation is acting in any kind of value-destroying or socially destructive, socially harmful manner. But, you know, finding out new ways to lobby the state to harm your competitors or to give you money from other people, that would be a socially destructive example of sort of political entrepreneurship, okay? You know, we all deal with, you know, you play the hand you're dealt. And if you're in the telecom sector or you're in the energy sector or the education sector or the financial services sector, one that is very heavily regulated by the state, you know, you would be doing a disservice to your shareholders if you did not try to do the best you could, given the regulatory and legal and antitrust environment that you face. Okay. Okay, we got about 10 minutes left. You know, there were some things that we didn't talk about in a lot of detail on Tuesday, like adverse selection. I can go over that a little bit more if you want. If there are any places, if you had a chance to look over the slides or to re-listen to parts of the lecture from Tuesday, if there are any particular holes or gaps that I can fill in, please let me know, and I'd be very happy to do so. There's, in response to Dean's question, there's been some interesting discussion on the forums about Mises' statement that was reported to me by Murray Rothbard and that I reported to you about the necessity to have a stock market to be a capitalist economy. Now, I'm not going to wade into the discussion of arguments about whether Nazi Germany counts as a capitalist economy or not. That's a don't-go-there area, you know, for me, but I didn't mean to make... I don't think we want to take that statement too literally. I don't think Mises was stating as a matter of praxeology that a stock market is a necessary or even a necessary and sufficient condition for having a capitalist economy. Really, the point that Mises was trying to make was simply that, you know, the most important market in capitalism is not the labor market, it's not the product market, it's not the market for raw materials or whatever, it's really the markets for financial capital. That financial markets are the most important ones, or are the critically important ones, that you can't talk about capitalism, you can't talk about a capitalist free market economy without analyzing how financial markets work. They're critically important. You know, a hampered financial market is even worse or more problematic than a hampered labor market. And that's really what Mises was trying to say. You know, I don't think we should push it too far on whether, you know, we can come up with lots of examples of, you know, highly socialistic economies that still had some degree of private asset ownership. Is that really capitalist or not? I don't know. We can keep arguing that forever. I don't think the taxonomical issue is the main one that we want to focus on. Mises is challenging us to think more broadly about the role of the stock market, of stock and bond markets, of futures markets, of financial markets, and so on, under capitalism, and how critically important they are. Yeah, maybe a rule of thumb, just a shorthand, again, a way to sort of challenge our thinking on it. I mean, I wouldn't want to live in an economy that has a stock market, but you know, massive government intervention everywhere else. I wouldn't call that a free society. excuse me. Dean, are there mainstream management theorists who have happened to hit on recommendations similar to yours and those of other Austrians? Or are the most successful management theorists just product of their times? Oh, Dean, I would almost say it's the reverse. I think that we Austrian economists working in areas of management and entrepreneurship and strategy, you know, at best, we're just kind of echoing what really skilled practitioners have done. We're trying to come to terms with what real-world entrepreneurs do and what makes them successful or less successful. Some of these ideas we've been talking about the M-form corporation, about the optimal degree of decentralization and so on. Look, it's not like some scholars came up with this and then it was put into practice. I mean, heavens knows, it's exactly the opposite, right? That Alfred P. Sloan at General Motors and Pierre DuPont at DuPont, you know, put the M-form into practice at those companies long before management scholars, whether Austrians or otherwise, you know, ever even noticed. What we've been doing, what people in my field are doing, is trying to use Austrian insights to make sense of the phenomena we observe in the real world. And, you know, my view of the consulting, management consulting industry is, you know, a little bit more on the cynical side, that, large firms don't need management consultants to tell them how to manage. Now, are there valuable services that management consultants can provide? Sure. There is some general knowledge about accounting techniques, about, you know, strategy matrices and so on, that can have some limited value to practitioners. But I think we tend to greatly exaggerate or overstate the influence that can, you know, the value that consulting can provide for large firms. Now, if it's in a very technical area, right? I mean, a lot of the consulting that McKinsey and the other big firms provide, you know, is really narrow stuff like IT. So if a large firm is going to implement a big ERP system, you know, PeopleSoft or SAS or something, yeah, it helps to bring in consultants who have a lot of experience doing that at other companies. That's fine. That's not sort of management consulting in a generic sense. A lot of firms bring in big gurus. You know, they bring in Michael Porter and pay him $10,000 for a speech or something like that. Maybe it's $50,000. Jim Collins gets maybe $100,000 to give a speech. Frankly, I think what Jim Collins is telling firms or conventions when he gives these $10,000 speeches or $50,000 speeches is just a bunch of baloney. It's a bunch of rah-rah cheerleader stuff. I don't think it has any value to practitioners. Why would a firm do this? Well, you know, there are a lot of interesting arguments about that. Maybe some of it is signaling to the market, hey, we're so rich and successful, and you're not, right? We can afford to hire Jim Collins and have him come in and do our annual, you know, shareholders retreat. Your company can't afford that. Ergo, you know, we have higher cash flows and higher projected cash flows than you. You know, maybe it's a signal to other firms. It's a signal to investors. It's a signal to potential employees. I think something like that is much more likely to be going on than companies thinking, oh my gosh, if we bring in Jim Collins, you know, he's going to generate more than $50,000 worth of new knowledge for us, and we're going to implement his techniques, and we're going to be the next great company. I really don't think that's true. I think, I don't want to pick on Jim Collins too much, but, there's a lot of evidence that, his most famous books, Built to Last and Good to Great, on what makes really great companies. You know, most of the companies that he used in those books have since gone belly up, have since gone bankrupt, or are now dogs. essentially, what he did in terms of research methodology was just engage in winner picking. He picked, 10 very successful companies at the time he was writing, and then sort of inferred backwards that, well, the things they did must be the reason why they were so good. Well, that's not appropriate scientific method, right? He should have chosen a set of companies that used a certain set of strategies and seen, on average, were they more successful or not than companies that used other strategies. Phil Rosenzweig's great book, The Halo Effect, documents in great detail how gurus like Collins, how their advice has been horrible, because the companies they just focused on good companies, and it turns out that a lot of the companies that were good at that time since turned out to be lousy. So those companies were good at that time for other reasons, not because of the specific strategies they used that Collins subsequently recommended. The point I'm making is it's very unclear what the role of management theory by Austrians or others is in contributing to management practice. I view my role more as kind of a chronicler or a documenter. My job is to document the things that entrepreneurs, to study, to understand, to try to make sense of the good things that entrepreneurs do, and to try to show to us as scholars, as observers, as analysts, as consumers, what it is that successful entrepreneurship is really all about. I'm not teaching people how to be entrepreneurs. If I knew how to do that, I would be an entrepreneur. I wouldn't be a teacher. Okay? Okay, Grayson has got a good quote from Mises, from Human Action. I'll just let you read the quote from Grayson, which I think is a good one. Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. That's a great quote from Human Action. Thanks for bringing it up, Grayson. Okay, we're about out of time. Any last minute? Anybody want to have the last word before I get back to grading? Going once. Going twice. Okay, well, let's continue our discussion as we always do in the forums. And feel free to drop me an email anytime about questions or post in the forums, and I'll do my best to answer. So thanks, everybody. Sorry for small technical glitches at the beginning and at the end. But look forward to our next visit together on Tuesday. Thanks a lot, guys.